I want people to know that doing a good piece of artwork is hard because people automatically assume we do artwork because it's all we can do.
Welcome to the Telling It Our Way podcast. I'm Allie.
And I'm Becca.
In this podcast, we bring you stories by disabled people about disabled people. Stories from the daily lives of self-advocates with intellectual and developmental disabilities.
These are real people with complicated lives. They don't want your pity and they do not exist to inspire you.
This is not inspiration porn.
Hey, Allie.
Hey, Becca.
We have a really fun show today. Have you ever dreamed of being a professional artist?
Who hasn't? I mean, I guess like even when I was little, I knew I didn't have like the talent or the resources to be a musician or a painter, though I did take beginning guitar class in high school to confirm that music instinct. But I did complete a BFA in college in writing and really thought I might try my hand at life as a poet. Still working on it. How about you, Becca?
I mean, I think it's been well established that I am a diehard theater kid. And so, of course, I was dreaming about being on Broadway. But I learned pretty early that being a professional artist is hard. It is a difficult career path. And I think it's hard for anybody to become a professional artist. But I think when we're talking about people with developmental disabilities, there are some additional ways in which it is very difficult to become professional. And it starts, I think, a lot with attitudes that people with developmental disabilities don't get their art taken seriously or don't have pathways into professional artistic careers or into the kinds of training that they might need. You know, so for example, it was only last year in 2024 that the first person with Down syndrome, a woman named Rachel Handlin, received an MFA. And it was for her photography. So please look her up and check out her photography because it's amazing. But that was just last year.
And you've written a little bit about the kinds of barriers that artists with intellectual and developmental disabilities face. And one of those things is social understanding, is that people with intellectual and developmental disabilities are just recipients of services. They're clients, they're service users. And so this kind of leads to undervaluing their contributions and not thinking that they have any intentionality or effort put into like whatever performance they can give.
Yeah, right. We sometimes see people with developmental disabilities not as makers, not as producers, just as recipients, right? And that's that stereotype about being a burden or needing to be taken care of, kind of in action. And that means, like I said, that often people with disabilities don't get their art taken seriously.
Yeah, and they're not given sort of support. They're not seen as independent makers. You've talked about that. Like if they have some sort of accommodation or an assistant that's helping them in some way, that they're not considered unique creators on their own.
Yeah, right. And also that this idea that people with disabilities are just making good art by accident, right? That there's no intention behind it. I think that's a really common stereotype and a really kind of nasty one, right? And so this idea that there isn't rigor or quality to the art that's being produced, you know, there are all of these kind of stereotypes that make it difficult for people to enter art as a viable career pathway.
Well, in today's show, we're going to introduce our listeners to two established professional artists who are really going to turn some of these assumptions around on their face. And so our first is Suzanne, and she's a painter. Let's listen.
I'm a professional artist. I do mainly acrylics on canvas and a little watercolor. I want people to know that doing a good piece of artwork to sell is hard because people automatically assume we do artwork because it's all we can do. I had an art instructor who taught me how to do more difficult pieces just to prove them wrong. My dad said artwork doesn't sell. That's why they have starving artist sales. And that most people don't sell artwork until they die. I thought to myself, thanks for the vote of confidence. I remember the first piece of artwork I ever sold. It was a tree in the background and a girl on a bike in the middle ground and flowers in the foreground. I had learned a lot of mixing techniques and how to tell a story in art. I was really happy when that piece sold. I would tell young artists to try to find a local professional artist and also take some classes. There are a lot of resources. I want to get out there that we don't just do art because it's all we can do. We do it because we like to do it and we're talented.
Becca, can you help us with a little context for Suzanne's story? And I'm asking you just because I know you worked with Suzanne in recording the story, so you have a little bit more background information. But I'm particularly interested in sort of thinking about what she means by she picked it up in her day program, and this idea that it was sort of art as therapy as was the assumption.
Yeah, so this is something I've written about in terms of disability and theater, but I think it applies to what Suzanne's talking about too, that there's often this assumption that when people with developmental disabilities are doing artistic things, it is because it is supposed to benefit them in some sort of therapeutic way, right? And so you're doing the art because it's good for you, not because you're producing art like an artist. And I think Suzanne does a really nice job pushing back against that, being like, no, I'm a good artist and people want to buy my work and I'm a professional artist, that really kind of undercuts this art as therapy. That's not to say that therapeutic art isn't important or good, but to say that, you know, when people with developmental disabilities produce art, we should value that art as art and not just as this idea of kind of benefiting the artist in some way.
Yeah, and that disabled artists, like any artist, really need to function in part if they're going to make a living as business people, right? And Suzanne says that she does art because she's good at it and people want to buy her art. And I think that's a really important point.
Yeah, and there's been some really cool counterexamples to this kind of art as therapy model that really embraces this idea of providing a supportive place for people with developmental disabilities to become professionals. And so one of the oldest examples of this is a place called Creative Growth in Oakland, California. It was founded in the 1970s, and it was explicitly founded as a place for artists with developmental disabilities to develop their work, their process, their aesthetic, and to really enter the contemporary art scene. And it was the home studio of a number of artists, including Judith Scott, who is a sculpture artist with Down syndrome, whose work has been featured in the Museum of Modern Art, the American Visionary Museum, the Museum of American Folklore, and so on and so forth. And I think that's just a really cool kind of counterexample to this stereotype of not taking art seriously. When you take it seriously, these are the results.
I think Judith Scott even has a cover image on one of my fancy feminist theory books, actually. I think that might be how I was first introduced to Judith Scott's work. One of the things that I think is really interesting now in the 2020s is that it's still really expensive to make art, but in some ways it's gotten easier because some forms of technology have gotten less expensive. And so our next artist that we're going to introduce you to is Jeremy, and he comes to us as a professional DJ. Let's listen.
Hi, my name is Jeremy Bellamy. This is my story. I really enjoy music. I love country, rock, and a little bit of rap, but not that much. My story is about my DJ business. It's called Road Dog DJ Service. I started on my own, and I proved that you can start something on your own and keep doing it. Mom and Dad said, "Oh, you wouldn't be able to do that." But I proved them that I could do that. To be a DJ, you need equipment. You have to have a mixer. You have to have an amplifier, microphone, and speakers. And you also have to have lights. There's a lot of work to be done. It's hard at first to hook up the equipment, but once you get used to it, you can do it. I got my equipment from the county board. When I got the equipment, the guy showed me how to do it. Then you have a playlist. I have over 9,000 songs. I got them from Spotify. It's tough to make a good playlist. I start out with my own music, but if anyone wants to come up and request, they can. My dad got me into a certain artist like Southside Johnny and Asbury Jukes. So every time I start a show now, I start with their song, Having a Party. It's a message to my dad. The first time I DJed, I felt like I could prove to my parents that I could do that. And I proved it to the county board. I have done provider companies, weddings, car shows, we tie together activities, and I've even done synergy. I even tried to become DJ on the radio. I've been out pretty much all over. I really enjoy it.
I think what's so great about Jeremy's story is the confidence with which he approaches this career path, right? He doesn't just say, "I like music," or, you know, "I like putting together playlists." He says, "I am going to be a professional DJ," even when the people around him are doubting him, whether that's family or anybody else. And I just really admire that.
Yeah. And I think that's really relatable too. So many of us can probably relate to the fact that we were told we couldn't do something. And so we developed more of a drive to succeed in doing that thing. And what I really appreciate about Jeremy is how he talks about the kinds of support, primarily financial, in buying his starting equipment and what he needed to get going. And, you know, the starting equipment that he needed is expensive, but not so expensive that an organization couldn't float the cost of that to get him off the ground and to get his business off the ground. So it isn't just talent that gets you to where you want to be as a working artist, but artists really do need investors.
Yeah. And so we have to take people with developmental disabilities seriously as artists in order to get them kind of seen by these investors as people who it's worth investing in, right?
Absolutely.
And so, Allie, can you tell me if somebody listening wants to be a professional artist, a person with a disability, where can they go to find more resources for disabled artists?
I am really glad you asked. So I was just looking around to make sure that I knew where sort of the most up-to-date lists of resources were. And so one group that's doing a great job creating a list of resources is the Black Disabled Creatives Collective. And so you can find their list of resources at blackdisabledcreatives.com/resources/orgs. And another one is actually the Disability Studies Group at NYU and their Proclaiming Disability Arts Project. And you can find them at disabilitystudies.nyu.edu/proclaiming-disability-arts. And guys, you can just see this info on our website on the transcripts.
Yeah, right. Check out the transcripts to get those links.
Mm-hmm.
Before we end, we just want to thank our contributors again, Suzanne and Jeremy, our associate producer, Connor Smenner, and our Telling It Our Way advisory board members, Jorita Fox, Quinn Thomas, and Gavin Daly.
And a special thanks to WGTE and our producer, Chris Pfeiffer.
To access transcripts for the show and any other show notes, please visit WGTE.org/ourway.
I'm Allie Day.
And I'm Becca Monteleone. And you've been listening to Telling It Our Way.
WGTE. Voices around us.